Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession, we're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Stubborn inflation, TikTok in the crosshairs, and round two of Biden versus Trump. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Harvard economist Ken Rogoff on the economic policies at issue in November's election.
They're certainly the two most protectionist presidents in a long time.
Cushman & Wakefield CEO Michelle Mackay on the state of the commercial real estate business.
I think that the struggle for all of us is that it's a gray zone out there.
And Elizabeth Economy of the Hoover Institution on what the 14th National People's Congress told us about the Chinese economy.
It's about control, control over the economy. And I'd say control over the information space.
But we begin with the most populous country in the world, India, which is now past China in people, and for some is an alternative to China for investment. Henry McVeigh is head of global macro and asset allocation for KKR and has just returned from the subcontinent. So, Henry, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
It's a fascinating note you write because you did this 12 years ago. How has it changed India since you did it the first time in depth?
Yeah, when I first joined KKR in 2011-12, we wrote a piece and we said, this is what India needs to do to hit its potential. One of them was invest in infrastructure. The second was reduce its deficits. It had twin deficits. And the third was stop subsidizing everything and let the real economy do its thing. And, you know, I was just back in there recently, and you can see from our piece, I mean, they have done those. I mean, a lot of credit to Modi. He's done an excellent job. But when you look at it right now, massive investment in infrastructure, particularly around roads, which is critical to that economy. Second is around data. And making sure that you can actually have the technology do what it's supposed to do as it relates to the internet, and then finally, I think about all the stuff around the rule of law and making a better bankruptcy court. You know, that's something where people, foreign capital now wants to be in India, and it's more active. And so it's a pretty good environment right now. As you mentioned, a lot of people are thinking, where can I get emerging markets growth? And what you see is while I'm talking about this latest update, India's public equity markets have been outperforming by about 700 basis points for the last 10 years. So this story, it's a growing one. It's getting better, but it's not a new one.
So those reforms you talk about, how do they manifest themselves in economic numbers? For example, growth. And by the way, we've always been concerned about inflation in India.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. One is real GDP has gone up since the past couple of years. There's more consumption in the economy. I think you're seeing the rise of the middle class, particularly the middle to slightly higher class. They're really starting to spend, and they're enjoying the benefits of that. The second is everybody now has a digital bank account, and so the government can be much more targeted in terms of doing fiscal subsidies, making sure that money is being transferred properly. And then the final thing is, unlike China or the United States, India has really created a technology platform that is agnostic. So their version of Amazon or the search engines is actually just to have something that's open to everybody, not having one private sector company control that. And over time, that could be a differentiated model. It's still early days, but those would be a couple of big changes we're seeing.
India's economic growth is driven by domestic consumption, something China has yet to achieve, as Chinese households continue to emphasize saving over spending. But Ishwar Prasad of Cornell says India will need to reinforce that domestic consumption with higher paying manufacturing jobs in order to continue its move up the global economic ladder.
India has a much higher rate of household consumption out of household income. Now, this is true, even though India's household saving rate is quite decent. And the overall national saving rate, however, is not quite on par with China, because corporations and especially the government don't quite save as much as those in China do. But in India, household consumption has been a very important driver of growth. And in particular, with the rising middle class, I think India has been counting on consumption to drive growth. The one problem that held back India's growth story is that the manufacturing sector for a long time was not doing very well. And it's hard for an economy to graduate from being low income or lower middle income to middle or upper middle income status without having a vibrant manufacturing sector that can generate high paying jobs. India is beginning to get there. So it's not only that the middle class is expanding, but high wage jobs are rising. So overall, I think the consumption story is much better in India than it is in China.
The good thing is they don't have to start by increasing from exports to consumption. The economy is almost, I think, 65 to 70% consumption to start off with. So it's really about increasing GDP per capita. That's why it's so important they keep inflation down, because you need to see real GDP per capita go up, which is tough in an economy that often has inflation. The second thing is they've done things around taxation to make sure there's something called the GST tax, where it's made it more efficient. So you actually have the ability to transport goods across different regions within India. In the past, you've had waste, and it's taken time, and the toll on actually getting the goods from one area to the other has been much worse. So that's improving. And then the final thing we're just seeing is there's more confidence in the consumer. We have exposure to different types of financial services companies in India, and actually the loss rates are down. So there's a confidence where people, they want to invest in their businesses, they're actually paying off their debts, and the consumer is spending a little bit more.
Economic reforms put in place by Prime Minister Modi's government have created the foundation for India's economic progress, resulting in improved consumer confidence. But there's a lot more to be done, particularly when it comes to growth in per capita income.
Again, here's Ishwar Prasad of Cornell.
That's going to be very difficult. The gulf that has opened up between India and even China in terms of national GDP overall or per capita income, that's going to be very difficult to bridge. A couple of decades ago, the two economies were in a very similar status in terms of their per capita incomes. And even in terms of size, China wasn't that far ahead. But right now, I think India's per capita income is probably around $2,000, $2,500, which is well below that of China, about a quarter of that of China. So that gap is going to be difficult to make up. And India is on track, perhaps in the next few years, to become the third largest economy in the world, but it's still going to be a much smaller economy than either China or the U.S.
GDP per capita goes up when you get urbanization. People come into the cities. They can use their skill sets. India's got a tremendous amount of skilled workers. They need to learn how to incorporate AI into what they're doing. They need to integrate into the global economy, but they also need to make sure that their wages are protected from the inflationary concerns. I think the administration clearly knows that in India, but they need to continually focus on that to make sure that you're getting kind of a rising tide lifting all boats.
Henry, it's always great to have you on Wall Street. Thank you for being here. That is Henry McFay of KKR. China has just held its 14th National People's Congress, setting out plans for its economy. Here to take us through what we learned is Elizabeth Economy, Hoover Institution's senior fellow. So welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks so much, David.
What did we learn?
I think the big takeaway from this NPC was basically that economic reform and opening is off the table for the foreseeable future. The message coming out of the NPC was basically all about state-directed, party-state-directed investment. You know, investment in the military, investment in R&D, investment in advanced manufacturing. You know, we even had a reference to a new leap forward, which is a kind of unfortunate reference back to the Great Leap Forward, which killed tens of millions of Chinese people. But I think, again, there was very little about the private sector, very little about welcoming back foreign investment, and very little about the consumer. So it's about control over the economy. And I'd say control over the information space.
What does that mean for growth? Because President Xi must be a little concerned about growth. He's got demographic issues, he's got real estate issues, he's got debt issues. He must be concerned about growth. Is that state control his theory about how he's going to get the thing growing again?
Absolutely. I think it's about investing in technology, right, and advanced manufacturing. And so when Xi Jinping talks about, you know, marshalling the new productive forces, right, he's very explicit. It's about space commerce. It's about EVs. It's about AI. You know, there's a whole AI plus initiative, right? They're going to integrate AI through all the sectors of the economy. It's moving away from the traditional investment in the property sector, which, as everybody knows, has, you know, been quite weak and sort of, you know, oversubscribed, into advanced manufacturing, into innovation. So that's how he's going to grow the economy. It's relying on those coastal provinces where you do have the innovation, you do have an incredible manufacturing ecosystem, and leaving the rest of the country really to suffer through.
One challenge President Xi faces is demographic, as the Chinese population ages and the birth rate remains low, which Ishwar Prasad of Cornell sees as driving the move to invest in technology in order to increase productivity.
They are looking to investment in the defense sector, partly for national security reasons, but partly also as a technology play. They are very keen to aggressively increase investment in the new technology sectors, especially green energy, electric vehicles, and a variety of other technologies that are seen as technologies of the future. So that's where the real emphasis is going to lie, because ultimately I think the Chinese government recognizes that if it wants the economy to grow in a sustainable way, it's going to have to generate much better productivity growth, because investment growth by itself is not going to do it, especially in the property sector and other sectors which traditionally used to drive growth. And with weakening demographics, productivity is really the one thing that can boost or at least hold up growth.
I was in China back in August and had the opportunity to meet with a number of senior economic officials. I went with Secretary Raimondo, and you know, we heard consistently all the way down from the premier down to the, you know, Minister of Commerce, they welcome foreign investment. They want U.S. business to be there. And they're all holding meetings with, you know, international business telling them that we welcome you. But there are no steps, there are no concrete steps being taken to demonstrate that welcome. And so what you have is the security apparatus in China taking all sorts of measures that in fact are signaling the opposite. And so I think there's really a battle between the economic reformers, the few that still remain, and the security apparatus. And it's really the security apparatus that Xi Jinping has empowered. And so I think in that battle, it's clear that the security side of things is winning.
Whatever the shape of the Chinese economy, it is the second largest in the world. China, the West cannot avoid China, dealing with China. So what is the U.S. and Western policy economically toward China right now?
I mean, I think, you know, there are many debates within the United States alone, but also among our European and Asian allies about how do we strike the right balance. And I think, you know, the code word, of course, is de-risking, right? And what does that mean and how do we look at that? And I think there are a number of ways in which, you know, we in the United States are de-risking. I think first there's the issue of de-risking around national security. And that's the most important thing, right? We want to make sure that whatever it is that we're selling to China or any investing that we're doing there or any investments that they're making here, we are not doing anything that is helping them technologically with, you know, products that are going to potentially undermine our own national security.
Okay, Elizabeth, it's really great to have you with us always on Wall Street Week. That is Elizabeth Economy of the Hoover Institution. Coming up, we go through the week in the markets with Peter Borsch of Computer Trading. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. The markets reacted to those stubborn inflation numbers this week, with the S&P 500 down for the second week in a row, this time by just over 0.1% to end at 5117. That is still comfortably above the median year-end number of 5,000 from our Bloomberg elves. The Nasdaq gave up 0.7%, and the yield on the 10-year climbed over 23 basis points to end the week at 4.3%. Here to explain it all to us is Peter Borsch. He's founder and CEO of Computer Trading Corporation. Peter, great to have you back with us. So great. What's going on? Is it all about those inflation numbers?
Well, I think it's a weight of the evidence, right? If you're a macro analyst, you know, you put a balance sheet together, say, okay, what's positive, what's not so positive? And I think Wall Street has a fatal attraction issue with Fed and interest rate cuts. And the weight of the evidence continues to suggest that they're not going to cut. I was here 3 months ago, and they said, oh, yeah, let's forecast a cut in 3 months. 3 months later, guess what? They have a meeting next week, and they're going to suggest cutting in June. I don't think that's going to happen. The weight of the evidence says that.
So talk about the weight of the evidence. And I must say, you pointed something out that's fascinating, and that's the story of cocoa. I'm not sure I would have looked at cocoa, but if you look at the chart on cocoa, it's quite extraordinary.
It's totally extraordinary, but it's one of the seven C's that I look at. Cotton, coffee, cocoa, copper, crude, and corn. And those things together are weight of the evidence in terms of inflation. Six of those seven markets are in uptrends. Only corn has been a little bit weak. So that says that there's inflationary pressures out there. That's what you have to look at.
Well, that's the question. We put up a chart actually showing the price of cocoa versus the price of NVIDIA, which you wouldn't think would be particularly correlated in any way, shape, or form. Yet they seem to track. Is that just a coincidence?
Well, I think when you get sort of into supply and demand shortages, particularly in commodities, there's nothing that moves more quickly. The point being that everybody thinks NVIDIA is crazy, but cocoa is crazy, and it can get more crazy. And going back to NVIDIA, if history is a guide, it may overtake Apple in terms of the second most capped stock. I don't think it's going to take over Microsoft. What that tells me is that we're in a particularly dangerous period in the stock market because you don't have this margin of safety. When you buy after a long downtrend, you have a margin of safety, right? The risk reward. Buying NVIDIA here, it may go up, 20-30% from here, but what's the margin of safety?
You talked about the Fed's meeting coming up next week, and we don't expect there to be any movement next week, but they'll probably tell us something or signal what's going out. There's a lot of concern, including some board members, actually, about the fact that we have very restrictive interest rates right now, that basically it will slow the economy down too much, and yet the economy doesn't seem to be slowing down, the stock market doesn't seem to be slowing down. So is it as restrictive as we think it is?
So on the surface, right, Bitcoin's at all-time high, gold's at all-time high, equities are right off their all-time highs, unemployment is at, continues to track below 4%. That doesn't seem very restrictive to me. Atlanta GDP came out yesterday, over 2%. Michigan, and I always have to go back to Michigan, of course.
Go blue. Right?
Yeah. Their economic inflation expectations came out today at 3%, and that's been sticky there. So 3%, 2% real GDP, that's over 5% nominal interest rates. The 10-year's only at 4.3. If you add one real interest rate, you could start seeing them go towards 6. The 2-year today made new highs in yields for the year. So the yield curve's getting more steep. So there's definitely a little bit of uncertainty out there, which it goes back to my point on the equity markets.
So what's an investor to do? How do you invest in that environment?
Look for that margin of safety. So in the case of the normal investor, if the stock market today is above all your ELV's objective for the end of the year, getting a little bit defensive is okay.
Yeah. Take some money off the table?
Absolutely.
That's interesting. So you would not be fully invested right now?
I'm never fully invested because you need to be diversified.
There's always some opportunity out there, you hope, right?
That's right.
Okay. Where are you looking for opportunities right now?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the energy market seems to have a little bit of some legs behind it. You're going into the summer driving season, and gasoline seems to be breaking out. If I were going to buy something with a bit of a margin of safety in case there's there, that would be the agriculture markets, which I just said, corn.
There you have it. Thank you so much, Peter. Always great to have you with us. That's Peter Borsch of Computer Trading.
Commercial real estate. It's been hit from two sides. First, when the pandemic drove people from their offices, and then when the Fed's rate hikes took values down.
Office commercial real estate in urban areas is suffering. Some of it's interest rates, some of it's just their transition to remote work and hybrid work is reducing demand for office space and creating high vacancy rates and stress for the landlords. If they have to refinance, about half a trillion is refinancing this year, they're going to have to refinance at higher rates.
Which puts pressure on the regional banks that had financed the deals in the first place.
I believe it's manageable, although there may be some institutions that are quite stressed by this problem.
It wouldn't stun me if, a bank or two ended up wrong-footed.
But some, like San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, say the problem is pretty much limited to office space in some urban areas.
Commercial real estate's a big name for a lot of different segments. So if you're in industrial and warehousing space, you're feeling very good about things right now. If you're in retail space or even multifamily housing out in suburban areas, then you're feeling really good.
And Daly believes that even the troubled parts of commercial real estate may be ready for a rebound.
I see private equity money, venture money sitting on the sidelines, ready to come in when the price is right. So there'll be some repricing, there'll be some loss of valuations for sure, but it doesn't seem today to be the kind of disorderly adjustment that you would worry about.
And here to take us through the world of commercial real estate is a true expert. She's Michelle Mackay, CEO of Cushman Wakefield. So welcome. Good to have you here, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
So we've heard an awful lot about commercial real estate in recent months. Not all of it good. Give us your perspective from Cushman Wakefield, because you have a particular way of looking at it.
Yeah, I do. And I think that there's been a lot of dialogue around the idea that there's a bifurcation of assets out there, higher quality and lower quality. I like to think of it as a trifurcation of the assets. So we have some super high quality assets out there in the office, industrial, and retail sector in particular who are untouchable, right? You saw them get through COVID. They demand higher rents. Everything is great. Then on the other bookend of this, you have assets that were struggling before COVID even started. And those assets continue to struggle and may never make it back. The meat of the conversation is around the middle of those markets and the assets that reside in the middle of those markets and how they're performing. And I think that the struggle for all of us is that it's a gray zone out there. We want to say it's good, it's bad, it's bottomed, it's recovered. We want to make a big statement about it, but it's nuanced. We think about some of them having financing that's coming due next year at substantially higher rates. We think about some of them that are owned purely in cash. Some markets could be compelling, like Baltimore, that you and I don't sit around and think about, or San Francisco, in contrast to New York. So I think that what's going on out there is a discovery process whereby people are trying to figure out which assets they want to get involved in, what has value. And at the end of the day, I do believe in 2024, we'll have some distress playing through the system, but that will just be helpful to getting us to the point of resolution.
So it's a large and complicated asset class, but we in the media like to make things really simple. And the question people are asking and addressing right now is, have we bottomed? And are we coming back up yet? We had John Gray from Blackstone just this week say he thinks we have bond. We had Mary Daly from San Francisco Fed saying she thinks there's money about to come in. What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think that if you want to say bottomed or not bottomed, you lean to we've bottomed. Because if you're going to make a macro statement about it, I would say somewhere around 80% of the assets are in really good shape. And 20% still have some issues to work through. We know that the Fed is most likely going to come out with some kind of rate cut. Powell's comments last week were dovish, irregardless of what's going on with inflation and kind of how sticky it's been. That gives everybody a point of view to think that there's recovery coming. When there's recovery coming and optimism in the real estate sector, people will start to make decisions. That's what takes you out of the bottom.
When it comes to offices, talk about the geography. You mentioned some of the geographical areas, but we hear, for example, San Francisco is very different from Chicago, very different from New York. And don't get me started about things like Dallas or Austin or Florida, Miami. What are you seeing?
I mean, we're seeing certain markets that are doing really well. I think that kind of top line headline is accurate, and you're seeing other markets that are really struggling. I think that when you take a step out of the United States, it's really compelling. I was just in India, in New Delhi. Those markets are doing really well in Asia. A lot of occupancy in the office market, a lot of occupancy here in New York City. We're doing pretty well here too.
How has real estate overall changed in the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, I love this question. We talk about the flow of dollars into the commercial real estate sector over the last 20 years. I've been in real estate a little over 30 years, and when I started, it was one of the only alternatives. You were never considered in the vein of equities or, you know, bonds and debt. I think today it's a core part of every money manager out there, which means there's just more capital behind it. And so in that way, it's changed. But let's talk about the human equation also post-COVID, the way that we talk about real estate. Yes, the office conversation has dominated the work from home, the return to office. But when you think about the ecosystem of real estate and certainly what we manage, we're involved in hospitals. We're involved in R&D. We're involved in protecting national art collections. We clean universities. You know, I mentioned Harvard to you in our conversation this morning. Real estate is really about what is built and what is out there in the built environment.
It's also about how it's used. Are you seeing changes in the way real estate's being configured in the wake of the pandemic and all the difficulties we've had?
Yeah, people are really reconsidering what has value. And it used to be that you could walk on to maybe any traditional office space and it would almost look like a trading floor. Right, a pod, a pod, a pod, a pod, and people are lined up almost like soldiers in that space. Now what you're seeing is more common area, and what you're seeing in terms of services companies like ourselves are groups that specialize in workplace solutioning. How you enter your space, how do you feel when you come into the space, how are you the most productive when you come into it? These are the questions our clients are starting to ask us, not just, can you find me 100,000 square feet? So we have to have the specialists for that. The other way that it's changed is that data is really important in decision making today. So if you and I were to walk down the street and you said, well, I'd like to be in this building, people don't make decisions like that anymore. They want to know, how does the employee get here? How long is the commute? Does that employee have the skills that I want? Where do they live? Right? How can I make them come to the office or incentivize to get them here?
Michelle, it's really a treat to have you on. I hope you come back.
Thank you.
That's Michelle Mackay of Cushman Wakefield. Coming up, how can the stock market be doing so well when our politics seem to be doing so badly? We ask Harvard economist Ken Rogoff.
Neither of them are going to regulate AI, and AI is behind a lot of the boom in the stock market.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. With the presidential candidates pretty much determined now, we've been asking a range of economists and other experts what differences the choice could make for global Wall Street. For his views, we welcome now Ken Rogoff. He's professor of economics at Harvard and former IMF chief economist. So, Ken, welcome back. Always great to have you on. You've written a piece for Project Syndicate in which you talk about the disconnect between a really robust stock market on the one hand and some real challenges politically. Why is there this disconnect? The stock market is doing so well. Politics, maybe not so much.
I have trouble reconciling it. The only thing I can think about in the article is that neither of them are going to regulate AI, and AI is behind a lot of the boom in the stock market. And they figure, well, it's going to be like social media, it's going to be like big tech, it's going to be like Bitcoin. In the end of the day, they're going to do nothing, and the stock market rolls along.
Well, talking about things that they might share in common in terms of policy, they also, perhaps, as you suggested in the piece, may share sort of a tendency toward protectionism, if I can call it that, sort of a populist approach on tariffs, as well as a reluctance to deal with the debt and the deficit.
Well, absolutely. So, obviously, Trump put in his tariffs, and Biden has essentially doubled down on it. Legal immigration is still really hard under Biden, you know, became much harder under Trump. I won't speak of the open border policies, but they both, you know, in that respect, were trying to shut out the outside world. And Trump's talking about expanding his tariffs. And Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, kind of misnamed, is very protectionist. I mean, the Europeans are livid about it. He does things that where you have to buy American in many ways. So they're certainly the two most protectionist presidents in a long time.
How much?
And, I'm sorry, you asked about the debt. And yes, I mean, Washington in general has a very relaxed attitude towards debt that I think they're going to be sorry about. Biden's speech suggested blowing up the debt. And of course, we have really no idea what Donald Trump will do. But that's what he did last time he was president. Good guess he will do it again. And as you know, David, you can't count on real interest rates being ultra low anymore. I think they're probably not going to be. And the idea that it's a free lunch, I think, is past thinking.
Yeah, I want to come back to the real interest, but before that, let's talk about tariffs for just for a second, because President Trump has said he wants 10% tariffs across the board for all countries worldwide. And by the way, he might increase them if anybody reciprocated with tariffs coming back. And against China, he's talking about 50 or even 60% tariffs. What likely effect could that have on the economy? I must say, we did have Paul Krugman on who said 10% tariffs don't make that much of a difference.
I mean, 10% tariffs would, I think, push up inflation. They'd push up interest rates. That certainly, back when Trump put in his tariffs in 2019, the Fed had to do an about-face on its interest rate policy because of the uncertainty and stress that caused. So, you know, it's one thing to talk about over a 50-year horizon, does it matter that much if you put in tariffs? If you do it out of the blue, it's very dislocating to the economy. I think it would be tend to be very recessionary, inflationary, and obviously other countries would retaliate.
So let's come back to that question you raised about the long-term real interest rates, because there is something of a disagreement, it appears. We had Mary Daly on from the San Francisco Fed recently, who said she still thinks it's around 2.5 to 3% sort of a long-term neutral rate, which is composed of various components, as you know so well. On the other hand, Larry Summers has come on and said it's much higher than that. You, in the past, have said you think it is higher.
No, I've studied the most the 10-year rate, really long-term data on 10-year rates. And, it's probably more in the range of 1.5 to 2% than in the 0% that it was from 2012 to 2021. The short-term rate, it's possible the term premiums change. But, you know, look at the economy. It doesn't feel like we have really tight monetary policy. If we were really 3% above a neutral rate right now, you would think that something would have hit faster and harder. And I would agree with my colleague Larry Summers that, you know, we're probably more like 1% or 1.5% above what would currently be a neutral rate. So if you're aiming for 2.5, I think you're going to end up stopping a long time before you get there.
So bring this back to the question of whether it is a President Biden or President Trump come next year. Either one of them is going to have to deal with the consequences of that. Take us through what some of the possible consequences are, because the assumptions put into the budget, for example, are much more modest when it comes to interest.
So there are two ways it can go. It could end up in inflation, which happened last time, which would eventually ratchet up interest rates. I think one of the reasons inflation's a little stuck at a high level is partly because if you've just experienced this inflation burst, things don't calm down right away. But so one possibility is there's inflation and then we ratchet up to higher and higher interest rates. But I think if the Fed were to stick to its guns and not allow that, then you're really not seeing interest rates come down. I think we're in an environment where there's so many demands on the government, even if neither candidate quite realizes that defense spending is going to have to go up. I think it went quite a bit down in Biden's budget proposal, and Trump presumably retreating out of NATO plans the same. I don't think so. Green transition is going to cost something. Populism and global debt's really high. There are a lot of upward pressures. And this environment where you can just jack up the U.S. debt and assume there'll effectively be no effect, you'll even see the interest rates drop. I think that was a post-financial crisis thing, and it's not a post-pandemic thing.
What does that mean for fiscal policy going forward? Whatever President Trump or President Biden wants to do going in, what constraints may they have on fiscal policy given what you just said?
Well, you take bigger and bigger risks as you blow up the debt. I mean, you can just keep borrowing all the money you need to pay the interest and keep expanding the debt. The CBO estimates bounce all over the place, but most recently they projected the debt GDP ratio getting to 170% in the year 2053. That really leaves a lot of room for accidents. So, yeah, we don't know what an upper limit is. There is no upper limit. But as you get higher and higher, it puts political pressures on the Fed. It puts volatility to inflation and interest rates. We will feel events that create pressures, that it's just not the free lunch.
Ken, how do you assess the prospect? We don't know, but the prospect, at least, the productivity and growth will save us. I mean, we have seen something of a productivity upsurge in just in recent months here. We don't know exactly what it is. Perhaps more immigration, actually, whether it's lawful or otherwise, and also some other source of productivity. Could we grow ourselves out of this problem?
I mean, first of all, in the immigration is good. but a rational immigration problem, yeah, a rational immigration policy would be better. I mean, if you tell me, let's spend $10 trillion, you can probably get some growth out of that. The U.S. has room to have immigration. You will get some, at least, you know, temporary boost perhaps out of that, but it's much less than it could be. You're giving up an asset by not having a rational immigration policy. AI, I'm a big believer in AI, but the question is, you know, is what we're seeing in the stock market a belief that firms are going to get a bigger share because they're going to be laying people off and it'll be, you know, globalization squared? There's certainly a lot of studies and reports showing that. Is it really going to be just much higher growth in the economy? I mean, it's sort of hard. So are firms getting a bigger piece of the pie, or is the pie growing faster?
Ken, it's such a treat to have you on. It's really helpful. That is Ken Rogoff of Harvard.
T.H. White wrote in The Once and Future King that the destiny of man is to unite, not to divide. If you keep on dividing, you end up as a collection of monkeys throwing nuts at each other out of separate trees. Sometimes it seems as though we're closer to those monkeys throwing nuts at one another than we are to a destiny of being united. Certainly it seems that way in politics. As we saw in the State of the Union address last week, when half the Congress cheered President Biden on,
we will not bow down.
And the other half heckled him. Even the historic unity between the United States and Israel is under increasing strain as President Biden presses for restraint.
And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire.
And Prime Minister Netanyahu will have none of it.
You cannot say you support Israel's right to exist and to defend itself and then oppose Israel when it exercises that right. You cannot say you support Israel's goal of destroying Hamas and then oppose Israel when it takes the actions necessary to achieve that goal.
And activist investor Nelson Peltz is throwing his share of nuts at Disney CEO Bob Iger as Peltz tries to break up the unity that Bob has long enjoyed with his shareholders.
Nelson Peltz is out with a manifesto for change over at Disney. Here it is. It's a 133-page white paper entitled Restore the Magic at the Walt Disney Company.
So in the midst of so much dissension that we see every day in the news, it's nice to know that there are some things we can all agree on. Like, for example, how much the United States regards the Chinese government with a distrust that sometimes borders on outright hostility.
There's a tremendous loss of confidence. Investment, foreign investment has collapsed. Domestic confidence has collapsed. It feels pretty bad.
And in particular, how Republicans and Democrats seem to be able to get together on trying to do something to TikTok, like make it get a non-Chinese owner.
The main thing, though, is we want TikTok to exist. We're not there to ban it. I've said we want to make it tic-tac-toe. We want to make it something that is not a fearful social media platform, but one that is very positive. And in order to do that, we have to see the divesting of it from the Chinese government.
Last week, we saw yet another example of people coming together, but this time it was people all dressed up and gathered in Hollywood to celebrate a range of motion pictures. Everything from one about a doll.
This is the best day ever.
It is the best day ever. So is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and every day from now until forever.
Yes! To a young woman in Victorian England brought back to life by a brain transplant.
She's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she is progressing at an accelerated pace.
And in the end, they united in agreeing that the best film of the year was one that portrayed the invention of the atom bomb, which led to the end of World War II.
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
Let's hope it doesn't take the threat of nuclear destruction to help us find unity on other controversial subjects. That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, data-powered transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.